3 is going to be familiar to most of you, I guess. It's probably one of the best known psalms of all of them. Personally, Psalm 23 was the first piece of the Bible that I remember memorizing. I can still remember kind of standing at the front of Sunday school, eyes half closed, feeling really proud of getting to the end. And as I look at it now, it's only 6 verses, isn't it? But it seemed like a bit of an achievement at the time. Many of others of you will remember perhaps singing these words, maybe at school or at weddings, or perhaps particularly at funerals. So what is it then about this psalm, about Psalm 23, which makes it so popular? Well, as I've already said, it's short, and so then maybe even a 7 or 8-year-old can remember it. And it's poetic, isn't it? The language is beautiful. The language is memorable. But I think the reason really why Psalm 23 is so popular is that it strikes a chord with us. This psalm contains both the promise of restoration, of being led by still waters, alongside the realism of feeling like you're in the valley of the shadow of death. Its subject really is how we get from the valley of the shadow of death to being led alongside quiet waters. How is it that we are able to feel both of those things, it seems, at the same time? How do we cope? How do we trust in God in the middle of a desperate situation? And a desperate situation is really the context for this psalm. It's a psalm of David, and as he writes it, he is very likely in fear for his life. In Psalm 22, the psalmist David writes, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And yet David can say here about that same God who he feels like he has forsaken him, that he is a God who makes him lie in green pastures, a God who restores his soul. So we might ask, how do you get from Psalm 22 to Psalm 23? Before anyone says it, it's not just by turning the page. That's the question that I want us to focus on this evening. How do we get from feeling like we've been forsaken, that we are in the valley of the shadow of death, to being sure that God is our shepherd and that we are being led by still waters? The answer to that question, I think, is the first 5 words of this psalm. The Lord is my shepherd. And that's my title for this evening. The Lord is my shepherd. I hope that by the end of this evening, we'll be able to lay hold more firmly of those 5 words for ourselves, and that we'll be able to see how that makes a difference to our lives, especially when they pass through the darkest of valleys. So we're going to think about the Lord being our shepherd, and we're going to do so under 3 headings. The first of which is this: the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not lack. Looking particularly at the first 3 verses of this psalm. David begins this psalm with a remarkable personal claim on God. David calls Yahweh, the God who created all things, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and Jacob, his personal shepherd. He doesn't say, Yahweh is our shepherd. He says God's relationship to him personally is like a shepherd and a sheep. Now, it's certainly true that God is the shepherd of his people corporately. In fact, a little bit later in the Psalms, in Psalm 78, David describes God leading Israel out of Egypt like a flock of sheep. Certainly, it's true that God is the shepherd of Israel. But the language that David uses in verse 1 and throughout this psalm is strikingly personal. God is Israel's shepherd. Yes, David says amen to that. But he also wants to say, God is my shepherd. He's the shepherd of my heart. David speaks of the God who is above all things as being intimately involved in his own life. And so he says with confidence, I shall not be in want. Literally, because Yahweh is my shepherd, I do not lack anything. Now, what David means by this becomes clear over the following verses. In verses 2, 3, and 4, David describes how God is the one who restores his soul, how God is the one who guides his life and the one who protects him from harm. It's clear, though, even at the beginning of this psalm, and particularly from verse 4, that David is not painting a picture of some kind of charmed life. He doesn't say that Christians will live in plenty, free from care, free from difficulty. How could he? If you know anything of David's biography, you'll know that he is a man who, yes, experienced great blessing, but also experienced great persecution. Rather, David says that since Yahweh, the faithful God of Israel, is his shepherd, then it is impossible for him to lack anything that is truly good or truly necessary for him to live. If it is true that the God who formed the earth and who formed David, who watches over, who loves his people, is on his side, then David can't really be vulnerable, no matter what his circumstances appear like now. Yes, he may suffer. Yes, he may be hurt. But ultimately, he can never be separated from God, from the God who loves him, from the God who restores his broken spirit, from the God who guides him along right paths. Yes, David knows that God is the life giver, both in the physical sense and in the spiritual sense. In Psalm 34, David spells out his meaning even more clearly. He says this in Psalm 34, verse 10. The lions may grow weak and hungry, but those who seek the Lord lack no good thing. In other words, even those who appear to be, humanly speaking, mighty and powerful, like a lion, are in reality vulnerable. Even lions get tired. Even lions become weak. Even lions can become hungry. They may lack things that are truly necessary in order to live. In contrast, those who seek God, no matter how it may appear on the surface, they are connected to someone who never grows tired, who never grows weak. They're connected to someone who truly is able to supply all of our needs. And as David so beautifully describes for us in verses 2 and 3, one who not only is able to care for our needs, but who delights to do so. Look what he says. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. Just as a shepherd looks after and cares for his sheep, so God cares for us. And David's statement is an uncompromising one. If Yahweh, if the Lord is personally our shepherd, then we will not lack. It's absolute. We have access to a God of infinite power and infinite love, a God who is capable and who desires to care for all our needs and who delights to care for us, his sheep. David will not allow any doubt to be cast in God's direction. The only issue, the only kind of chink in the armor, as it were, that can be prized open is whether or not we can say those first five words with David: the Lord is my personally, my shepherd. A friend of mine has a habit of saying that nearly every concern in the Christian life has at its root the question, is God really good? Is God someone that I can trust? Does he really care about me? Does he really love me? And how does that match up with the context that I find myself in now? David's call to us, and I think to his own heart here, is to declare a resounding yes. Yes, God loves you. Yes, God cares for you. Yes, he is good. Yes, he is capable and willing to give you everything that you need. And as we're about to see, David says that this is true all of the time. When it's easy to see God's blessings and when we face real pain and real difficulty. How can he say this? Well, if we fast forward into the New Testament, we see the Apostle Paul making exactly the same argument. In Romans 8, he writes this: if God is for us, who can be against us? He who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not also, along with him, graciously give us all things? David, as an Israelite, could look back in history and he could see the God who led his people out of slavery in Egypt. He could see the God of the Exodus. And he could say, this is the God who leads his flock through the Red Sea into the desert and who cares for all the needs. He is my shepherd. But sitting here this evening, we're more privileged than David. Because we can look back, yes, and see the God of the Exodus, but we can also see the God who did not spare his own son, who gave up what was most precious to him, and who allowed him to be nailed to a cross for us. And with Paul, we argue with our hearts and say, well, how will that God not give us everything else? The God who has not withheld from us already the very best of things, how will he not give us what is truly good? So that's the first lesson that David teaches us from moving from Psalm 22, from feeling abandoned, from walking in the shadow of death, to Psalm 23, from desperation to comfort, is to remember who God is and to remember what our relationship with him is if we trust in him. God is still God, no matter what goes on. He is powerful, he is mighty, and for those who have confessed our sin and who have called on his name, he is our shepherd. He is our redeemer. He is our restorer. He is our guide. He is our source of life. And that's the first anchor, if you like, in times of trouble, back into reality. So first, God is our shepherd, our shepherd. Secondly, our shepherd is always there to protect us, so we need not fear. That's point two. The Lord is my shepherd, I will not fear. Looking at verse 4. Verse 4 says this, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me, your rod and your staff, they comfort me. Even, David says, or in the AV, yea, despite the valley of the shadow of death, despite difficulty, despite trial, despite persecution, despite desperation, David will not fear. Now, the first thing to say here is that the valley of the shadow of death is real. Whether David here is referring to a literal road, perhaps a dark ravine, maybe near Bethlehem where bandits would have stalked his life, or whether he is using this as an image to describe more broadly the very real danger and betrayal and anguish that David has lived through, it's real. It's real, and so it demands an even, or a despite, or a yea, or a yet. David says, even though I face real danger, even though I face real suffering, even though I face things that are truly painful, things that may threaten my life, or at least threaten to pull it apart, even though I lose my security, even though I lose my best friend, even though I lose my health, even though I don't have the things that my heart desperately cries for, even though I face death itself, see evil all around me, God is my shepherd. How can David say that? Well, firstly, he says that his shepherd is with him. For you are with me. David's God, his shepherd, is with him always. Even in this valley of the shadow of death, God is there. This is an intensely personal psalm that David is referring to God in very personal terms. But in verse 4, there's a kind of shift again. David moves from talking in the third person. In verses 1 to 3, he says, my shepherd, he makes, he leads, he restores. But in verse 4, it kind of changes. It's more immediate. He says, you are with me, your rod and your staff, they comfort me. Having stood back, as it were, from the situation in verses 1 to 3, having taken stock of the situation, having remembered, well, what is really true about God? What is the unchanging reality of who he is and what our relationship with him is? It's almost now as if David plunges back into his immediate context. If you go, well, hang on, I'm facing suffering, I'm facing death now. How does this apply to me now in this context? And David says, yes, even here. Even as I suffer, even as I face the shadow of death, God is here. And not in some mere intellectual sense that it's technically true that God is somehow omnipresent and so he must be here even though it's difficult. It's true somewhere, I know. No, he's here, he's present, he's felt. He's with David, comforting him in the valley. We know, don't we, how precious a person's presence can be, just someone being with us. I can remember being on holiday a few years ago with some friends in the south of Germany, and we'd been in the car all day. and we were driving home. It was very late at night. We'd been in the car since before dawn, and all of us were just really tired, and so we weren't talking. And my friend said to me, "Well, isn't it wonderful to be such good friends that we don't have to speak, that just being with each other is enough?" And yet that pleasure is still less precious than the presence of someone that we love when things are going wrong. When the person who you hope would walk through the door actually does walk through the door. That's precious, isn't it? David says that he will not fear evil, even when he experiences it, because closer than that evil is God, his shepherd, the lover of his soul, the sustainer of his life. He need not fear evil because his shepherd is with him. But more than that, his shepherd comforts and protects him. Under painful circumstances, a person's presence can sometimes be almost all that we need. But even more helpful, even more precious than someone being with us, is someone being with us who can actually help us, who can actually do something about the situation. And that's David's God. He is present, and that's precious. But more than that, he can help. He's active. David pictures God here as his defender, as one whose rod and staff comfort him. Perhaps David is thinking of a shepherd's crook lifting a sheep out of danger, whose staff is able to hold back those who would harm him. David's God protects and sustains him. His life may not be taken from him because it is held firmly in the hands of God. David remembers his God, his friend. You are here with me now, in this anguish, in this danger. And you are not impotent. You are powerful. David's theology, which he's rested on in the first three verses of this psalm, his knowledge of who God is and of how he relates to him, are not abstract. They're not just things that he can write down in a book or explain to other people. They're things that he experiences, that he knows are true, that are like muscle memory to him when he faces pain and difficulty. In fact, it's here in the valley of the shadow of death that these truths are being refined, that they are being imprinted on his heart ever more deeply. And so David cries out and he says, "Yes, you're with me, your rod, your staff, they comfort me." Knowing God's presence, knowing God's protection, provides real and heartfelt comfort, even in the valley of the shadow of death. These are realities that David can rest in, that he can stand upon now while he's buffeted by trials, while he is exposed to evil. And so here's our second lesson tonight: to carefully apply our theology, to place our faith in the reality of God's love and care for us, and to cultivate our experience of his presence, to deeply trust in God's promises to us, so that when things are difficult, we can cling on when we're tempted to fear. We have no need to fear, because like David, our shepherd is with us. Our shepherd comforts us. Our shepherd saves us. And again, we are more privileged, aren't we, than David. We look back to the cross. We look back and see our shepherd's great love for us. We read earlier, didn't we, from John chapter 10. That incredible passage where Jesus himself describes himself as our good shepherd. He says this in verse 14, "I am the good shepherd. I know my sheep, and my sheep know me. Just as the Father knows me, and I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep." When we're tempted to doubt, when we are exposed to trial and to suffering, we look back and see our shepherd. A shepherd who laid down his life for the sheep, who laid down his life for us. Our shepherd knows us. He knows us with complete intimacy. He knows the good, he knows the bad. And yet he loves us. He loves us such that he'd have compassion upon us. He loves us such that he would suffer alongside us. He loves us such that he would lay down under no compulsion other than love his own life for us. Jesus is our good shepherd. So when David says, "My God is with me," we say Jesus left heaven and came to earth for me. When David says, Well, God's staff lifts me out of danger. His rod protects me from evil. Well, we say, Jesus laid down his life for me. Jesus has lifted me out of my sin, out of my shame. Jesus has nailed to the cross everything that stood against me and has risen to new life, defeating death, defeating all evil, putting it to rights. And so we fear no evil. That's point two. The Lord is my shepherd. I will not fear. Why? Because God, our shepherd, is with us and because he comforts us and protects us. And thirdly and finally, the Lord is my shepherd and I will live for him forever. Looking at those final two verses of the psalm, verses 5 and 6. If verses 1 to 3, as it were, kind of pointed back for David to remember who God is and what he has done, and if verse 4 plunged him back into the present situation and said, well, how do I apply that now in the valley of the shadow of death? Verses 5 and 6 change tense again. They look to the future. They look forward to what God will accomplish for us as our shepherd. Verses 5 and 6 should be thought of as in the future tense, but there's something slightly strange about them. Verses 5 and 6 are things that David is looking forward to. They are things that he's putting his hope in. But the way that David writes makes it sound as if they've already happened, or at least as if they're an imminent reality. David imagines for us a great banquet set before him, a table prepared in front of his defeated enemies. He imagines himself as being on the victorious side in battle, and coming now to enjoy that victory. David trusts that that will be the reality for him, despite the fact that now he experiences pain and sorrow. David looks to God now as the one who restores his broken soul, the one who leads him in righteousness, who comforts him. But there's a destination which David looks to beyond the trials of this life. One day, though David does know the reality of God's presence now, there's going to be something even more incredible. Yes, God is with him now, but in a new way, in a more unimaginable and great way, God will be with us in heaven. We will be with him and we'll know him and see him as he truly is. One day, David will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. He will know God and will be known by God and will be able to enjoy him perfectly. One day, David will pass through the dark ravine of the shadow of death and will leave it permanently. And he will approach the one who is in unapproachable light. Simply put, David knows the certain hope of heaven. As David wonders at the sight of sharing this great banquet meal with God, the suffering which he experiences now retreats. Just as Paul will later write about the persecution of the early church being light and momentary, so David's troubles, David's problems shrink back in the face of the joy that will be his when he lives in God's presence. Now, that isn't to say that the valley of the shadow of death isn't real. That isn't to say that the valley of the shadow of death isn't difficult. That isn't to say that David's suffering doesn't test his faith. But in comparison with the glory of God, in comparison with the joy of knowing him forever, it is small. I don't know if many of you watched the Olympics over the summer, and if you ever noticed what some of the athletes do before they take part in a race, as well as kind of limbering up and warming up, doing the physical preparation, they do mental preparation as well. You can sometimes see this. So you can see, I kind of imagine maybe in the Winter Olympics, like somebody who's doing the bobsleigh, and you see them kind of their eyes closed, kind of doing this. What are they doing? Well, I believe that the kind of the technical term is visualization. They are imagining what they need to do over the next 10 seconds, if you're Usain Bolt, or you know, 3, 4, 5 hours, if you're Andy Murray. What are the things, what are the steps I'm going to need to take in order to be victorious? What does success look like? And what is it going to feel like when I win? What is it going to feel like when I complete the marathon, when I burst through that tape, when the gold medal is hung around my neck? And this stuff is useful. It's powerful. There's a reason why athletes do that. It helps them to get in a place where they can perform at the peak of their abilities. And if you like, David is doing something similar and yet different to that here. David is able to visualize himself in heaven, to imagine himself sitting at a table with God, enjoying his blessing, knowing the abundance that waits for him. And that's not just a kind of a picture or a pipe dream. It is a reality which reaches back into the present day and allows David not only to cope, but to thrive under pressure, under difficulty. David may write, even whilst facing real trial, without lurching into platitudes, he's able to say in verse 6, surely this is true, goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life. God's love and blessing, as it were, are pursuing David. They are driving him towards his final destination, which isn't the valley of the shadow of death, but is heaven, is the house of God where he will dwell forever. How's David going to get there? Well, not by performing to the peak of his abilities, not by smashing the forehand down the line, not by getting up into the sprint as quickly as possible. No, David's hope, his certainty, lie in God, in his grace, in his mercy. And our hope lies in Jesus' death and resurrection. We will dwell in heaven with God. We will be raised to life and seated with Christ. Not because we will have achieved it, but because Christ's resurrection has already achieved it for us. And so whilst we wait, like David now, our task is to apply that knowledge, to apply that theology to the context of our lives, and to say, even though I suffer, even though I walk through the shadow of death, it is true. God's goodness and God's mercy pursue me. And one day I will live, I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Let's pray.